Q&A, where you ask us the questions. We've got a panel of three of us. Joining us on the panel, Mark or myself, is Monica Cook. Welcome, Monica.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Monica is a qualified sexologist holding a Master's of Sexual and Reproductive Health in Psychosexual Therapy through the University of Sydney. She also has a graduate diploma in science communication and an advanced medical research degree with honours. She's got lots of years of experience in sex, fertility and health education through numerous organisations, and she's currently working for the Australian Centre for Sexual Health in St Leonard's and for Mindspace in Mona Vale. So she's a really good complement to Michael and my voices, and, you know, if something gets too hard, we're just going to pass it her way, aren't we, Michael?
And her name starts with M.
What does a healthy sex life for a married Christian couple look like?
Yeah, I think that's a really great question. And I think when people ask it, they're often looking to me to give them some number in terms of frequency or, you know, what sort of should be included in the repertoire. But I'm actually going to resist that because I don't think it's actually helpful. And I don't think comparisons are helpful. It's possible to be normal but not be average, if that makes sense in this field.
Yeah.
And so it doesn't really matter what the national average is and what's happening with everyone else. Mm. It's actually up to each individual couple to do what they kind of enjoy in that space. But having said that, I think there are some really helpful guides that the Bible gives us in terms of what a healthy sex life for a married Christian couple looks like. And I think the first one of those is the fact that the Bible makes it quite clear that sex is a gift. It's not an entitlement or a hunger that needs and must be satiated, which means that sex can be requested but not demanded, and the answer needs to be respected. So I actually think how consent is navigated is a really important part of a healthy sex life for couples. I think the second one is that in the Bible you see this huge emphasis on mutuality, you know, that your body is not your own, it belongs to the other is often a very controversial verse.
Yeah, there's 1 Corinthians 7, isn't
it? That's 1 Corinthians 7, it's very, you know, it can be used for actually non-consensual concepts, but as I read it, it's actually, it highlights how sex is a protective, other person-centered love where the focus isn't actually on what do I need, but what in our oneness, what does our relationship need? So it's really a mutual pursuit of each other's pleasure. That's important. And I think couples that get that right also enjoy a really healthy sex life. And just the final aspect of that is looking to 1 Corinthians 13. So that passage on love.
Yeah.
I love that because I replace the word love with making love, because in some ways, sex is a physical form, a bodily form of expression of love. So, you know, I throw that out at couples and say, well, let's read it as that, you know, making love is kind. How's that going in your relationship? Is it, it doesn't envy, does not boast, it's not proud, doesn't dishonor the other. It's not self-seeking, it's not easily angered, it keeps no record of wrongs and it rejoices with the truth. So it's a really powerful kind of measuring stick for couples to read that passage and see, okay, how is our sex life going on that front? Is it trusting? Is it hoping? Is it persevering? Is it protective? And so those three things, consent, mutuality, and those key elements of what it means to love in sex, I think are really important to healthy sexuality.
So Monica, I really like what you said about 1 Corinthians 7 because I think sometimes we interpret that as purely self-disinterested. You know, I'm purely selfless in sex. And sex is not purely selfless, is it?
No.
In fact, it's kind of awful when someone is just performing a duty that doesn't feel like being loved in return.
Exactly.
But you said the relationship in the mutuality was the focus. Is that getting you right there?
Yeah. So there's a sort of, you know, that two become one. There's a oneness there, and you're each caring for that space, and you're actually giving and receiving at the same time in sex, which is the beauty of that act.
Yeah, I also love what you did with 1 Corinthians 13 there, and I would throw in Song of Songs into the mix there, and talking about that the mutuality of that your pleasure doesn't detract from someone else's pleasure.
Exactly.
That you can both pursue your pleasure and pursue someone else's pleasure at the same time, that sex is actually an amazing place where those two pursuits come together.
Exactly. And that desire can be healthy.
Mm.
Mm-hmm.
So what makes people so anxious about this question, the healthy sex life? Is it the numbers? Or, I mean, because a lot of people would say, I guess a lot of couples would come in and say, there's an imbalance of desire between us here, and it's, you know, doesn't seem to be matching up. So yeah. How do we navigate that in a healthy way?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think part of that, we are surrounded by what sex should look like. And so the people that come into me are often really grappling with this. They have a lot of shoulds. We should be doing it this often. Mm. It should look in this particular way. And if it's not, there's something wrong with us. We're broken. And I think part of that is moving away again, like I said right at the beginning, from the should, and actually starting to look at, okay, what do we actually each enjoy? What is our meaning for sex? What do we get out of this? What are some mutual things that we do that we both enjoy? And starting from that place and moving forward, rather than starting from that place of difference, of you want it this often, I don't, you know. And once we start on a place of that journey, and knowing also for couples to know there's help in that space of navigating desire difference, that there's actually evidence, good evidence-based research that helps couples move through that, is also part of what I do, and absolutely wonderful once couples get on the page.
What's a healthier way of being aware of the attractional dimension of personal presentation without descending to shaming and blaming?
I think this is a really interesting one, because I think when you're looking at stuff like that, Christians really always are looking for a black and white answer. They're wanting a line to be drawn in the sand. And I think that what that means is that either you're shamed if you don't live up to that line, or you can also be self-righteous if you are keeping to all those rules. So we're actually looking at law, which becomes a sort of issue of it becomes condemning. It starts to be blaming and shaming. But I always recommend in this space wisdom, which I believe actually loves and protects, and it protects self and it protects others. And it's also quite nuanced as well, which means that, you know, in terms of how what we wear in a particular individual situation might look different depending on context, depending on culture, depending on what you're feeling like that day. And so, you know, I think that, you know, the idea of personal presentation, that's sort of indicating what should I wear, when should I wear it, is this right, is this wrong? I don't like to move in that direction of saying this is right, this is wrong, this is... But when you're wearing something, is that loving in that context? And to be a little more nuanced, is that protecting self? Mm. Is that loving my brothers and sisters in Christ? And why? And also looking at the why, the motive behind why you're wearing that.
I guess we also struggle, and partly, of course, in the wider context is the sexualization of our culture, and it's, at one level, it's shamelessness.
Yes.
We also struggle as we see someone attractive and we think, oh my goodness, I can't be attracted to anyone except this one person. And if I'm single, well, then nobody. And yet it's probably good for us to just relax and say, that's an attractive woman or man. Isn't that great?
Well, I tend to go, thank you, God. What a fantastic job you're doing there.
Yes, without the lingering lustful thoughts that kind of using of them in that way, it's okay to recognize and recognize that's a, you know, there's an attractive person.
Yeah.
And that will give us a little bit more of a sort of takes a bit of a chill pill about that.
Yes.
So that's from the subjective side. That's from the perception side. That's not from the how I dress side, I guess.
What's really interesting for me about this being framed around wearing is that it's really about one sense, and we're not monosense people. So actually I asked a question, you know, what's some sexy songs that people know? And people immediately had songs that they could think of. Really interestingly, a lot of people were naming songs with male voices, and we often very much concentrate on the female presentation when we're talking about, you know, temptation and shame and so on. But actually, it's in the fullness of other people that we can appreciate, because instead of using the word tempting, we can appreciate other people in all sorts of ways in a sexual way. And that can be through a lot of senses or through a connection that's beyond the senses. And so sort of to narrow it down to what someone's wearing actually is a truncation of our sexuality, I think.
And can present sexually seductively in lots of different ways.
Yeah, yeah.
For instance, or absolutely. Manipulatively.
You know, I could use my voice seductively.
Stop it.
I was bound to do that at some point in this episode. So one thing ignores the wholeness of sexuality, which I think is something that the culture does, and I think Christians can bring a whole person sexuality in. But I also think it does tend to lead to a thing where it becomes the woman's problem. And that ignores that women can be visually attracted as well anyway, like men in suits. that all of us are attracted to different things. We've all got sort of different things. Something might be more attractive to one person than another person. So
I'm interested in how porn impacts young people's expectations of sex, especially for young people who might feel pressured into sex and in relationship to gender roles and expectations in sex.
I guess it'd be great to have a conversation about or to hear from you about porn in general, Monica. What's your sense about this question and its problematic nature in relationships, in adult relationships? We're kind of blaming young people here, but adult relationships are affected too.
Yeah, no, it's definitely an area that I engage with a lot, and I see a lot of people, young people, and as you say, people that are older in more committed relationships struggling with porn and the unhelpful influence that it has on their life, and that might look different. I think it's particularly an issue with the younger generation because of just the way that the plasticity of their brains and the way that they are developing, and then to sort of inject porn into that developing brain means that it is quite hard when it comes to neuroplastically rewiring the brain. It becomes more challenging, and not to say it's impossible. Yeah, I think part of the issue is that people are seeing porn as educational and not entertainment. And one thing I always am telling people is that it's almost like watching Jackie Chan and thinking that you can go out and do the same and that you're going to defend yourself in the same way. It's just ridiculous because we all know that Jackie Chan, even the moves
even Jackie
that he does,
Chan can't do it.
He can't even do it, right? It's just the angles, the shots, the sounds, yeah, everything definitely is manufactured for entertainment purposes. And it's not realistic to copy at all and not helpful. And porn is exactly the same. Mm. Everything is manufactured, that the angles and the sounds and all the actors and what they're doing and what they're saying is just an act. And so when people go in and see that, and try and replicate that or think that that's the ultimate lovemaking, ultimate in lovemaking, it's really problematic. And so one of the outcomes of that I see is a lot of shame and doubt around one's own ability to perform in the bedroom. And so actually now more than ever, people are having less sex. And I wonder whether it's because people are afraid to fumble in the bedroom. You know, they're really afraid to give things a go because they should be these amazing porn stars that they see. And it's just easier to not go there. It's less confronting to face the fact that they're not as awesome in the bedroom as what they're seeing. So there's a lot of unrealistic expectations that develop in light of what sex should be, you know, and also thinking that my partner should enjoy something a particular way. There's the assumption that, oh, yeah, she's definitely going to enjoy this or he's definitely going to enjoy this, and no consent, no talking about it. Is this feeling good? None of that conversation because it's not what they see.
That's really interesting what you're saying there, because I've had people who say, oh, but consent's not sexy. But I think, as you're saying, that's like a lie being sold to us by the performance we've seen of sex, even in, like, if you're taking away from pornography as well, just mainstream movies. Mm-hmm. But actually, consent navigated well is sexy in a different way, probably a healthier way, in that, you know, you can actually turn each other on with that care for each other, with talking. Like, talking is sexy. So the communication that consent requires can be a sexual act in itself.
Yes.
Yeah, I think the deep tragedy, speaking from the male perspective of porn, is the way in which porn and prostitution trades in the illusion of women's desire of the male. Mm-hmm. And so it actually shows men really want to be wanted and want to be desired, but yet it has to be kind of, they can't work out how to kind of navigate that. They just want a quick way to be desired and the illusion of that. And that's why I think it leaves such an empty, hollow feeling in the end, because it has to be manufactured. It's not actually, it actually leaves you feeling not desired in the end. And that's, I mean, I think that's kind of worth pointing out how desperately sad it can be, despite its addictiveness and its attraction and its ease.
And because of the high expectations, it leaves people heading towards porn more, because it's more confronting to actually have to work in the space of another human being. Mm. That can get quite confronting. So it's a sort of negative cycle. The more uncertain you become of self, the easier it becomes to avoid that situation of having to engage with another person. And because that's difficult, there's no control in that situation, whereas with porn, you're just sitting back, you're receiving, there's no expectations of you. Mm. You're in control at every moment. But when you're actually engaging with a human being, there's consent to be navigated, there's communication, there's stuff expected of you as you're receiving. It's a totally different ball game.
And I've heard people also saying that a lot of pornography these days, it's not what people used to be exposed to before. So the internet, people are exposed to more violent porn, which is also a problem with young people being exposed to it, that their idea of what's normal sex becomes this non-consensual violent sex, and that's meant to be something that's desiring. And I actually have heard quite a few stories of young Christians having problems with that in terms of what is being expected, particularly by men.
Yes,
I think that's right. And I think there, at one level, remember a few years ago, a book put out by a prominent pastor who's been mentioned on this podcast before about sex, and he says, well, anything's open for a couple.
Mark Driscoll.
Yeah, awesome. Anything's open for a couple in the bedroom, so ask, just ask away, etc. You can do anything you like there. And at one level, I agree with him, but on the other level, because of the context in which certain sexual activities take place, the meaning that's given to them in porn, I think it becomes extremely problematic over the kind of consent and pressure issue, because it's kind of referencing that world.
Mm. Yeah, and porn actually separates things like emotion and empathy and intimacy and love and affection. It's separated from the act of sex. And then consent, respect, emotional connection, safety, health, they're all missing from that picture, which is
so
problematic.
Monica, in your profession, is this a controversial view?
Yeah, although it's changing. So there is some evidence that, say, couples watching porn together can help their relationship in some form. But the evidence for it being unhelpful is more stacked up. There's more issues around the negative outcomes of watching porn than there are the positive. And they're the things that I've been more concerned about in that space.
And is there probably a difference there? Because I don't think we've brought this up, but I think it's been underlying what we're saying. There's a difference between explicit sexuality and pornography, which I see pornography as damaged or harmful sexuality. But the problem is things that are produced which are just sex tend to go that direction. Yes. But if you're watching a mainstream movie which has some sex scenes in it, often there is a context given to that that gives you a place to understand that sex there. If it's bad sex, actually, you start to see why it's bad sex, and that's quite helpful. And if it's good sex, you do see some of the emotional connection in there. So it's actually a different kind of experience from pornography.
Yeah, I mean, I think I'd counsel wisdom, and also, that's the problem is you don't know till you see it. And so you don't know what's going to be helpful, unhelpful until you're actually in one level watching what you're watching.
Maybe that's why too.
In an ordinary movie.
Talking. Yeah. Like Christians should talk about what they watch together and should talk about sex together.
Mm.
Yeah, much more than we do.
And I think also the other thing to mention is the fact that the way the porn's made is, it's coming out now that it falls under the category of supernormal stimuli. Mm. So it's a stimulus, which is a stimulus that evokes a much larger response than the one that has evolutionary significance.
Yeah.
So over time, this can then cause interest in normal stimuli to wane. That's a little bit different. There's something about the porn that is meaning that ordinary stimulus isn't working anymore because they're adjusting to higher and higher levels. And I've met guys that are triple screening porn. So it's not even just one screen in front of them that they're receiving this, the image from.
Wow,
it's so three screens
at once.
Which is completely, it's not very replicable in an ordinary relationship, sexual relationship.
No, really?
So, there are complications and complexities there too.
Suppose there's someone who grew up being taught that it's a sin to feel sexual attraction. The said person now realizes that isn't true, But in the meantime, she's deliberately ignored any sexual feelings she was experiencing. And now she just finds it hard to feel or notice sexual attraction. So how does she learn this in a healthy way?
I think this is a great question, and I see this all the time in my work. People coming in and really not knowing how to experience sexual feelings. They've suppressed it. They've pushed it down so deep. And they might be in a marriage relationship now and they're just not entirely sure how to re-access those feelings. And I would say the first thing that I'm always dealing with is shame and trying to work with that. And there's a wonderful book written by a lady called Tina Shermer Sellers called Sex, God and the Conservative Church, Erasing Shame from Sexual Intimacy. And I really love, she provides a framework which I loosely adhere to, which is about, she follows four things. The first one is frame. So provide people like this a clear framework for understanding sexuality with helpful evidence-based research to fill those knowledge gaps. So you have something to hang your experiences on, and especially experiences moving forward. Then there's name. So actually telling your story to a safe group of people who can compassionately listen to you and encourage you, that kind of cuts across the idea of shame, which is kind of disarms the feeling of loneliness and secrecy and fear of rejection around what you may have done or what you might be feeling. So it's about sharing your story. Then there's claim. This is a really important stage of working through this, which is where you kind of reclaim your body so you can be brought into relationship with it again. A lot of what I do is somatic in-body work. I think part of this, you know, in the Christian, the kind of Christian history is a kind of dualism, a separation between mind and body, and the body, flesh is evil and the mind is good and upright and spiritual and pure. And so I actually, you know, Jesus was embodied. it's not, you know, the body is good. And so I bring people back into their bodies to reclaim their bodies as good and healthy, you know, so that those sensations and desires can start to be felt again in their body. And then finally, aim is the idea of forming a new sexual legacy. Mm. What is your new story? Like, reflect on where your beliefs came from and what values and personal beliefs are you going to move forward with? And so, you know, how does that align with scripture for you? And trying to help people form the language around that is a really important aspect of overcoming this sort of thing that this lady or person has written.
I'm seriously going to send you clients after we've been talking today. I mean, this is sort of getting into what people often call purity culture, I think. Mm-hmm. And I do think, and I'm going to speak here as a Christian leader, I do think that sometimes the way that churches have dealt with it has been a problem. Because I think there was a bit of a, oh, you know, everyone thinks Christians are against sex, so we need to say sex is good. But what you would get often in my experience, people would say, sex is great, it's a gift from God. Here's all the don'ts. Like, it would just be straight in. So what are people going to hear? Of course they're going to hear messages of shame. And then some of the things like that sort of almost, there's no coming back from losing your virginity at the wrong time or something, as if it's a particular specific kind of sin that's different from other kind of sin or that kind of thing. So there's a lot of ways that we've talked about it that has done that. And I'm actually really grateful to my parents, who are a minister and a therapist, in just being really modelling really frank, open discussion of sexuality at home, and that desire is something really natural. And they talk about, you know, how they were attracted to other people in front of each other, which was fun. But they would also, actually, you know, openly kiss each other in front of us. And so actually for me growing up, there was a really good balance between going, you know, some boundaries around sex are really helpful to make sex be what it should be, but also that in and of itself, it is a really fantastic, joyful, playful thing. And I think we really haven't got that message right yet, because I actually think when you look at the Bible, I mean, the whole Song of Songs is there to kind of give us that balance.
Yeah, I think that we forget, the context of the sexual revolution in the 60s and 70s, and churches trying to hold back the tide there, and youth group leaders trying to speak in the midst of a very different culture and a sharp difference now emerging between what's true in the outside culture and what Christians are trying to hold on to. And I think probably doing it in a clumsy kind of way. And so and we see this kind of thing. A number of our questions actually were asking about purity culture and its effects. And I guess so while Monica has talked about the sort of the therapeutic and spiritual options for the person who's kind of growing out of that, I think it's really great for us, be really great for us who work in churches and voluntary level and as Christian parents and those in ministry to think really carefully about how we do sex education in sex as part of our Christian discipleship and how we speak about it in a way which isn't, at the one hand, isn't just a kind, it's not boundaryless, as you said, but actually holds it to be precious and helps people not to feel the kind of shame we're talking about. But I know it's a very difficult thing to do that.
I mean, I guess, Barry, I don't think it's necessarily that difficult because I saw it done well.
You did see it
growing up. But I think part of that too, as you say, sex education, if we don't talk about sex much in terms of what it's like with experience and that kind of thing to people, then what happens is they're getting the no's from church and they're getting the sex education from somewhere else, and that's a problem. That's actually when we see really unhealthy types of sexuality coming out.
Masturbation. Is it sinful?
I actually really love this question. It's one of my most asked questions as a sexologist and a Christian one at that. I have quite a unique view in this space because the research and certainly my experience shows that what I call actually self-pleasure, so self-pleasure or self-exploration, is really an important part of healthy sexuality, particularly for women. Mm. And the research backs that. And so, but I do understand the purpose of sex biblically and aspects that I guess are coupled with masturbation, like porn use and things that mean that it can be unhelpful. So I've landed at a place where I think there is a healthy and unhealthy way to masturbate. That is my position. And I think part of that is looking at, you know, when people ask Jesus questions where they're wanting a black and white answer, he always pushed back with a question to reveal the person's heart motive. Mm. And I like to do the same thing. And I think it's quite revealing to really look into yourself and think, well, why am I doing this? What is the motive behind my masturbation? And that is revealing. And so I think, you know, you can ask these questions. Is there a good start? Is your desire inextricably linked to evil thoughts that dishonor brothers and sisters? Does it support an industry of abuse and exploitation? Does it stem from a lack of contentment in the current situation that God's placed you and lead you further away from God as you're resentfully reminded of what you're missing out on? Is it a way of controlling or justifying feelings of shame or guilt that might relate to some other aspect of your life? Is it a sexual expression of a fuller yearning for connectedness that could only truly be found in an authentic relationship with God? In other words, by harboring lust, do we limit our own intimacy with God? You know, is it drawing you away from your spouse because you're doing it in secret? Is it a habit that locks you into a kind of sex that your partner could never duplicate, which is an issue that I see in my clinic all the time? Is it a laziness or fear of intimacy with a partner? They're some of the things you need to be asking. Or are you masturbating to release stress and tension at the end of the day, to self-soothe? Are you doing it to help you achieve sexual purity and maintain a level of self-control and focus with strong desires, bodily desires? Is it an act of self-discovery that stems from a curiosity for what feels good? Is it a way of you owning your body? Are you using it to reclaim your body after trauma or abuse? So I think there's just so many reasons there. It's difficult to just put a line in the sand again and say, this is right or this is wrong, this activity. But I think it's about going deeper into the concept and really questioning the motives behind why that person is engaging in that kind of activity.
Well, as a theologian, I'm going to back you up. So that's...
Yeah.
I mean, you know, I don't think there's anything in the Bible about not masturbating at all. There was a verse people used to use which actually was completely about something else, about Onan. And I think it is a practice, as you say, which it's how you do it and the heart behind it. And I agree with you. I think that a lot of particularly Christian women haven't masturbated, and that's a real problem when they get into a marriage relationship, in not understanding their own bodies and what they've got pleasure in and that kind of thing. And even like because we often talk about it as you were just saying, you know, controlling your own desire, which I think we think about as a singleness thing. But I actually wonder whether that's part of, and you could probably help with this, part of in a marriage where if there is some difference of desire, that masturbation could be something which helps a partner who perhaps wants it more or as you say, wants to use it for self-soothing, but the other partner just wants to go to sleep, right?
Yeah, exactly.
That it could be quite a useful way of actually caring for the other person.
Yeah, and, you know, I think in people get so caught up on intercourse and the sort of, you know, the end point of sex. But as a sexologist, I broaden that right out. I'm not looking at that final end point. Masturbation is sometimes, you know, the final, you know, if the journey is an exit plan off a highway is what I call it. You know, you're going down a highway for whatever reason, the other person calls time out. It's like, that's enough. And maybe that person needs to take it a little further. And then that's where masturbation is a really helpful outlet. So long as it's not done in secret, it's talked about, it's communicated, and there's between the couple, they're comfortable with that, which is always important. So yeah, I think it is really important to, and talking about biblical stuff, even in Leviticus, I think there is a passage that talks about uncleanness in the context of sex, and then also uncleanness in the context of a different kind of admission.
Yeah, yeah.
We don't know whether that's, you know, referring to
involuntary or voluntary.
But I think the Bible would have made a point if it had any problems with it. And I just think that biblically it wasn't considered sex at all. Sex is something for marriage between two people, but it kind of fell into its own sort of category.
I think the only thing I would add is that if you don't feel anxious that you don't, because we turn everything into anxieties, right? I don't want people to hear us and think, oh, I've got to...
It's my like, Bible I've got study to start and smoking. Now my masturbation. I've got to fit that in.
So because I'm aware of people's capacity to turn everything into that. If you don't, then that's okay too, you know.
Yes.
And there are risks. I mean, you've described them really, really well. You know, there are dangerous waters here, and look to your heart. I think it's just a brilliant way of conceiving the whole thing.
And the other thing I like to draw people's attention to is in the Song of Songs, the fantasy element of that, where they're imagining things that they're doing to each other, you know, and I think we need more practice at being able to kind of channel, you know, what we enjoy with another person, not with a specific person, but just the ideas of like, what do we enjoy? What are things that open us up? It's helpful to reflect on. And you see two people in the Bible actually imagining what they wanted to do with each other, which I think is beautiful.
Yeah, because there's a lot of mind in sex, isn't
there? Yeah, yeah.
How can single people embrace a healthy sexuality?
I think what single people get told a lot is that they have this sexual desire that they can't really move anywhere, or they can't apply it in any sense, especially if they're told that masturbation is not right. So they're kind of just left to suppress it down deep is usually what I hear from. And I just a bit of a disclaimer, I mainly work with couples that are married and I myself am married. So I'm speaking not as a person that deeply understands this idea, but I want to say this. I think it's really healthy to not suppress those desires, but actually to move closer towards them, to try and understand what's in those desires. What would they gain in having sex? What does sex mean to them? And it means different things for different people. So for some people, sex means validation. For others, it's a chance to have fun. For others, it's connection. For others, it's just, there's so many different meanings for sex. And what can sometimes happen, and what I see with particularly men that come into my clinic, is they channel all of those needs through sex. So sex becomes this huge, important part of their life because they're getting their friendship, they're getting their connection, they're getting their fun, they're getting their validation all through the channel of sex. And once we start to sort of say, well, what other things can give you fun? What other ways can you feel connected? What other ways can you feel intimate? And suddenly they start diversifying a little. Then the desire to have so much sex dwindles because they're receiving their needs in other ways. And I think that in the same way for single people, instead of moving away from their desires and trying to suppress them, pretend they don't exist, I would really encourage them to move towards them in curiosity, to think through, what is this telling me about what sex means to me? And then trying to meet that either in relationship with others or in their relationship with God. He can also meet us in intimacy and connectedness and validation in who we are. All of those things that I've mentioned.
I think that's really valuable because also we've tended to think chastity and celibacy is for singles, not for, and then there's these married people who just can go like the clappers and that's funny. There's nothing problem there. But
great phrase.
Yeah. And I think the thing is actually sexual self-control is something that is actually given to all Christians to pursue.
Mm. Yes.
You know, and I know married couples where through ill health, for instance, there has to be many years maybe of sexual self-control by one of the partners because the other partner is not able to have sex. And so we should all be, I think, that should be a conversation that everybody participates in. Mm. How do I manage my sexual self? Or how do I think about my sex? What does sex mean to me? In marriage or not in marriage. I'm married now, but marriage is a temporary earthly state.
Yes.
One day I may die first, but I will be single again otherwise.
Yes.
So I've got to think about that.
And I think also if you take this back to when we're told about the creation of sexuality in Genesis, certainly it's physical there, but it's also about, as you're saying, intimacy, connection, relationship, that there's a core there. That it's not only people having sex are experiencing that reason for sexuality. So in that sort of larger core, all of us, so single people, married people, all of us have a lot of desires for intimacy, for being seen, for being known. And even within marriage, you may not get that all from your partner.
Exactly. And I think there's a place, I do grief work with clients that, you know, just because they have a particular desire doesn't mean it'll always be met in their marriage forever. Sometimes there's a grief process that says, you know, I really want this particular thing. The partner is very firm about them not ever engaging in that particular act, not sex full stop, but a particular type of sex or a particular activity. And then they have to sort of grieve that, you know, and go through the fact that, okay, maybe this is just not ever going to be a possibility, but it's, there's also the rest of the relationship that is worth it, is worth them investing in that and not focusing in on what they're missing out on, this one aspect, and rejoicing in the fact that they have this wonderful relationship with their partner. And I think the other thing is that not all desires are good either. Mm. To be aware of the fact that you have, or healthy desires, just because you have a desire doesn't mean it must be met, I guess is the point I'm making.
Yeah, I want to go to Latvia. But, you know.
Travel is pretty much that's an unhealthy
not a,
desire.
That's not a euphemism.
okay.
I'd love you to discuss the secular ideal of sexual compatibility. It's so important, it seems unthinkable not to try before you buy, versus the imperfection and relational complexity of sex in marriage.
It's a little bit of a wordy question, but it's the just so often the case that I find signed up, committed Christians now live together before they get married, just as a matter of course, and partly there's pressure from their parents, you know, that it's the baby boomer generation pressuring their kids to try before you buy. It just seems to be the normal way to go.
Yeah, and I think, I really do think this idea of sexual compatibility is overrated. I'm not saying it doesn't exist. I'm not saying that there aren't two people that come together that just enjoy the same things, are really good at using their body in space, really super coordinated, and, you know, which I think people are thinking of when they think sexual compatibility. It just works, you know, and it works well. But that's not to say that couples that don't have this can't enjoy or cultivate a satisfying and enjoyable sex life. As just one aspect of their overall relationship. And I think that's important to emphasize as well. It's just one aspect of the bigger picture. And I think the biggest lie that society tells us is that sex is natural and it just happens if the person's right for you.
Didn't George Michael say that? It must be true.
And I can tell you it's not true. From personal experience, like any other aspect of a relationship, it requires work, intentionality, commitment. And even if you're lucky enough to be sexually compatible at one stage of your life, I guarantee you that sexual dynamics are like an evolving landscape. It will change. It'll change with a season of children. It'll change with a season of sickness. It may change as you go through menopause. So what started out being compatible starts to be incompatible, and you need to work through that. Every couple, I guarantee you, will need to navigate compatibility as an essential skill of their sexual life. Mm-hmm. And I see that all the time. And so if you start out being compatible, eventually you may not be.
Or may not always go that easy.
Exactly.
It's interesting, actually, because I want to sort of turn this around, because what you're talking about, Michael, is the message maybe you're getting from outside. But actually the message that I got, and I hear people still getting it, when I was a young adult, was, oh, they've just got to be single, like available, the opposite sex, you know, and a Christian, and Bob's your uncle. Perhaps not the best phrase there. But, you know, as if that was something not to be considered at all. But when I've prepared couples for marriage, I kind of think, why would you, if this is someone you're not desiring at all in that way, then don't embark on this with them. Because you will then discover someone that you do actually desire that with later on. So it's not like there's just one person. And I think sexual compatibility is actually about a broader type of compatibility, because we're whole people. Mm. But I do think that I do know a lot of Christians where I saw they went into marriage and actually really it was really just a friendship. Or sometimes even less than that.
I know examples of that, yeah, where people said, look, we're best friends and we hang out all the time. Yeah, so why don't we just make it a permanent arrangement? And that's kind of spelt disaster, really, because although on the other hand, I think too, a friendship can evolve into a deep sexual relationship too.
And can it's have not different the be-all and end-all, and you can make, but wisdom, I think, suggests that this is perhaps one of the things that you might try and discover beforehand. But you can discover whether you're sexually interested in someone without going the whole way, you know. Yeah,
that's right. And, I mean, there's also whole cultures, like I'm half Indian,
yeah,
where there are arranged marriages and they start out from a place of non-desire, non-knowing of any of either of them. And I work with those couples too, and it's really interesting to see how it is possible to cultivate desire and sexual attraction over time if there's motivation there. And I think that's the key. If in our culture, I guess it's not the norm that you would just find somebody that is just a friend or you know, and just to marry them and pursue a healthy sexual functioning. But there are, you know, most of the people in, or a lot of people in the Indian community will meet in a sort of arranged format, and that introduces its own challenges. But it's certainly not, it's not like impossible to overcome those challenges to have a very satisfying sex life.
I think the problem is in the West at the moment, you've got infinite choice because you can just go on whatever app you've got and you can choose someone from anywhere in the world. Yes. And so you're always looking for the more compatible one. And there's a sort of idealism that kind of kills it, really.
I suspect part of the problem too, though, is, and that probably presents across a lot of cultures, is that Christianity says actually it's okay not to marry. So, you know, like, so if you're just pursuing marriage, why are you pursuing the marriage? Why do you want to do that?
Yes.
Are you just finding someone just for the sake of being married? I don't think, like, you know, go into marriage wanting to cherish the person that you're married to.
Yeah, I think Christianity says singleness is more than okay. It's actually better.
Well, I think that there's a balance of that in the biblical testimony.
Yeah.
But, yeah.
What exactly was meant by the expression sexual immorality in Romans 13 or 1 Corinthians 6, Galatians 5? And how should we apply the instruction to avoid sexual immorality today?
We've got a biblical question here, and it's a particular word.
Porneia.
Which is the word from which we get pornography from.
Yes.
And it comes up in a number of New Testament texts, especially with Paul.
Yes.
He tells us to flee sexual immorality.
If he likes that word, yeah.
Yeah, flee sexual immorality. He also says, of course, there were people who are engaged in sexual immorality who are now the sanctified. So he doesn't, it's certainly not unforgivable, 1 Corinthians 6 and 7. What do you think about this word, Megan?
Look, I think actually what it points to towards, I mean, I think it's a word that's talking about any kind of harmful use of your sexuality. And I think we'd all agree that, and as we've been talking about, all good things can be used harmfully. And I think maybe that's been one of the things sometimes that the culture hasn't sort of agreed that, you know, it's kind of everything just needs consent. But actually, you know, sexuality can hurt yourself and other people. And so I think that's really pointing to having a loving type of sexuality. And I actually think that some of the rules that we have that God has given us around sexuality are precisely to promote both a healthy sexuality for the individual and within community. Because, I think the Me Too movement has shown us that it's not happening in a sort of blank slate world when we perform our sexuality. And so what we get a lot is, you know, things like power imbalances come in when people go to act sexually that we need to be aware of. So, you know, sexual harassment and sexual abuse happen even in places with traditional morality. And I think those things are part of what Paul means here as well. It's about any use of our sexuality which is going to harm other people and who we are.
So I'd say that porneia is particularly extramarital, like it's in particular, but as we apply it, I think we should say you can do sexual immorality inside your marriage.
Well, it's used in it is used about extramarital, but it's used in a few different ways, isn't it? I mean, there's a generality to the term.
Yeah, it's a broad term. It's not just sex outside marriage. Yeah. It's a broad term. And of course, the ancients, don't be naive about the ancients. They weren't naive. They had everything. So,
the Greco-Roman world was, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I just really wanted to add the fact that, you know, God's standards around sexual immorality are pretty high. Mm. You know, there's a passage that sort of says that even if you just look at a woman lustfully, it's the same as adultery. And so, you know, it can be really easy to get caught up in, once again, that shame space of around sexual immorality. Is this immoral? Is this not? But I really want to emphasize the fact that we all don't measure up to God's standards in this space of sexual morality, and that very fact moves us closer towards grace and what Jesus did for all of us in allowing us the ability to still draw close to God in repentance and also in faith during times where we feel like we don't measure up. So I just wanted to put that out there as well. I think sometimes when we talk about sexual immorality, there's this real kind of heavy feel in the discussion, and it should be heavy because, as you say, it hurts people and it hurts self. But I think there's also grace there that is healing and restorative and shouldn't separate us from the love of God, but draw us closer to Him.
With All Due Respect is hosted by Megan Powell-Dutoit and me, Michael Jensen, produced by Mark Hadley. The editing is done by Bella Ann Sanchez. With All Due Respect is part of the Eternity Podcast Network, an audio collection showcasing the seriously good news of faith today. Head to eternitypodcasts.com, where you'll find show notes and other stuff related to our episodes, and click on to our Facebook page to join in the debates. With All Due Respect.
You've been listening to the Eternity Podcast Network, eternitypodcasts.com.au.